Thanks for tuning in to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 30.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robertson.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and present their story ideas to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we get dirty. We dig into it and toss things around and talk about what works and what doesn't, and bury some of the more ridiculous ideas that usually come from Dave and I. But all through it all, we end up finding what we're really looking for, which is what?
Literary gold.
Damn straight.
We're going to get dirty.
on this one.
Oh, dude, how have you been?
I've been good, man. I'm directing a show at my high school.
And, oh, really?
We just had auditions, and I'm going to have callbacks on Tuesday, and so it's going to be fabulous. But as of this recording, which is now when people are listening to this, it's going to be like, what, 2 months later or something. I believe that it's someone's birthday, isn't it? Coming up soon?
You talking about me?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. When
it's actually, I mean, when people listen to this, it'll be past, so everybody will have to send you belated birthday cards.
That's true. But this is our last recording before my birthday. You're absolutely right. Right. It's been my birthday for the last week, because we don't do birthdays in the Robinson household. We do birth weeks.
That's
because
right.
One day is simply not enough to contain the awesome power of the birthday. So we kind of combine Hanukkah and birthdays. So every day there's a card, there's a present, and the universe is usually very generous to me and gives me some amazing event as it goes through. I love birth weeks. So
yeah. Yes. And you saw your spirit animal recently.
That's right. Yeah, I was hanging out back, taking a smoke break, and there's this big old field and this tree right up against the field, and I always hear this hawk. It's the hawk cry. It's just great sound, but I went out back, and there he was, just big as life, sitting on a branch, and he was doing his hawk shriek, and of course, goofball that I am, I hawk shrieked back, and so he hawk shrieks, and then I hawk shriek, and we did that for like 5 minutes. I had this great conversation with a hawk, so yeah, that was an epic birthday gift from the universe.
Very that cool. Was very well, cool. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And you know what else is awesome?
Well, I know what you're about to say, so yeah.
Yeah, it's the guest hosts, man. Guest hosts are freaking awesome, too.
Totally.
And why don't we go ahead and welcome our guest host to the big chair at the round table. Ladies and gentlemen, Hugo Award-winning, Nebula nominated, Edward Norton Award nominated, RPG tie-in novels, kick-ass sorcerers. I mean, the man has spanned globes, walking between the worlds time and time again, and he's thankfully takes us along with him. Please welcome back to the big chair, Master Tim Pratt. Tim, thanks for... Yay! There was much rejoicing! Everybody says I need to have like an applause sub...
We do, yeah.
Sub sound that pops up there. So, Tim, thanks for coming back, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I like applause. Feel free.
Yes, woo! Yay. Here we go. That was lame. That was really lame. Tim, with all the things that are behind you and all the projects that you have going on right now, I can only imagine what your day planner looks like. So would you be so kind as to share with us and our listeners what's coming up for Tim Pratt? What do you have coming out? Where are you going to be? Give everybody a rundown on the awesomeness that is Prattville.
All right, big excitement, which is going to be old news by the time this actually airs. Right now, at this moment, I'm in the midst of doing a Kickstarter project for a short story collection. It'll be my third collection. The first two I did through small press publishers. And it sort of occurred to me as I was putting together the third one, I could shop it around to small press publishers. But I wonder how much just my readers would give me. So I launched this Kickstarter for a book called Antiquities Intangibles, which is going to come out. My plan is to try and have it out around November. And the really cool thing is that as a sort of stretch goal, when it became apparent the Kickstarter was going to make rather more money than I'd asked for, I thought, well, I'll do something nice if it gets to whatever arbitrary amount. And I decided I would do my complete stories. And alas, that's only for people who support the Kickstarter, but they're going to get an ebook single story I've ever done.
Oh my God. That's epic.
I'm a backer.
Oh, you are a backer?
Yes, I am. So I'm going to be looking for that.
It's going to be cool. It's going to be a lot of work, but the actual collection, Antiquities and Tangibles, will be for sale in print and ebook form, hopefully by the end of the year. The other cool thing, this won't be out until next year, but I'm co-editing an anthology with my friend Melissa Marr, who's a great, best known for her young adult work, her Wicked Lovely series. She kind of brought me in to help co-edit this great book called Rags and Bones, and that's going to be out next fall. Probably, we don't have a definite date yet, but sometime fall 2013. It's awesome. It's got a Gene Wolfe story, Garth Nix story, Ricky Yancey, Holly Black, Kelly Armstrong, lots of just great people in it. So that's the pretty big stuff. I have another Pathfinder Tales novel coming out sometime. I don't know when. I think we decided to call it Liar's Blade. It's about an asshole and his best friend who's a magical talking sword.
That's awesome. And what about conventions? Any cons that you're going to be making the scene at?
Not really. I did a lot of conventions last year, so this year I've basically taken off. I think I will probably be, my hope is that I will be at WISCON, the Feminist Science Fiction Convention, next Memorial Day weekend, next spring. But this year I'm not going anywhere. My wife's going to Worldcon next week. I'm staying home and very happy to not be traveling after way too much traveling last year.
I hear that. Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Tim. We'll make sure all of that gets into the liner notes. Is there anything else, any other far-reaching things, maybe some speculative possibilities in the future?
Oh, I have a book called The Deep Woods, which is actually it's a short novel, long novella, which is kind of a contemporary fantasy thing that I really like a lot, that's coming out from PS Publishing, British Small Press, like in 2014, probably. They just bought that. And Pathfinder wants me to do another book, a sequel to City of the Fallen Sky, which we're in talks about. I mean, we have to make sure it'll work out, but they would like to see more happen with those characters, so I might do that as well. And this fall, probably for my own amusement, I'm going to write a contemporary fantasy novel on spec. I've mostly been writing books that are sold. The past year's been really busy, and this is a book entirely for myself. I mean, I'll try to sell it when it's written, obviously, but there's no deadline, there's no editor, there's no expectations. Maybe in theory, that'll come out someday.
How long has it been since you've done that, Tim?
Year before last, I wrote The Deep Woods entirely for my own amusement. Last year was really pretty much writing, and it's not that I didn't like The Constantine Affliction was a book I'd wanted to write for years and finally had the chance, but it was under contract. I did have a deadline. I did have to actually, treat it like a job and stuff. So being able to fiddle around and scribble stuff and, play with things and have it take forever, we'll actually be fine this fall. I've had a really busy year. You were talking about how jammed my schedule must be. In fact, no, I'm taking like a month or two off after the end of August. I have very carefully said no to things and pushed away deadlines, and almost everything is done on September 1st, and I'm just going to play video games for a month. That's going to be great.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. Just video games. Sure. We'll check in with you in a couple of weeks, see how that's going for you. Excellent. All right, gents. Let's take a short break at this point, and we'll give some airtime to another awesome podcast or very cool ebook or other audio experience, because we're all about that here. And when we come back, we will workshop a fabulous story idea. Sound good?
Sounds brilliant.
Excellent. All right, friends. You guys stay tuned. We will be right back.
The U.S. government created Division 10 to track down mysterious flyers possessing technology beyond our own. Now, a corporation, Typhon System-wide, plans to steal alien tech from the grasp of the Division, and they're willing to take down a president to do it. As Typhon's plans come to a head, something escapes from a burning building in New York City. Corporate mercenaries are on the way, and so are the black helicopters of Division 10, but there's another player in this game, and far higher stakes than control of a government or technology. The Flyers are back. Subversion, a science fiction adventure novel by John Miro. Conspiracies, spies, and aliens. In enemy lines, the lines aren't as clear as you think. Buy it now on Kindle. Learn more at servingworlds.com.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. and moving right into the workshop proper with our guest host, Tim Pratt, which is so cool. And so, Dave, let's do this thing. Tell us
absolutely
who we have as a writer.
Because we can't do this. This podcast does not happen without brave and courageous guest writers willing to put their story ideas up for discussion by the roundtable group. So much respect to our guest writer. Brian, our guest writer's soul is actually possessed by one of the trickster gods. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's awesome. And this trickster god infuses his mind with multiple creative lusts and passions, goading him to create visual art, music, photography, and, of course, words. Lots and lots of words. His book, A Dead God's Wrath, was self-pubbed last year, and this year he's releasing a short novel in the same vein, Total Depravity. You can check out his visual creations at deviantart.com under the screen name Rusty87D, and his blog is rustyweb2bs.blogspot.com, which of course gives away all of the drama of who our guest writer is. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the coveted guest writer chair, Mr. Rusty Webb. Rusty, thanks for joining us, man, and for sharing the story. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And how Dead God's Wrath, Total Depravity, is one a sequel to the other? What's the framework there?
They're more like interconnected stories. I had written a novel a few years ago, which never saw the light of day, that had such an extensive backstory. I felt like it's about an artifact that, you know, goes through history. And I thought, why not just start writing about them? And that's that.
There you go. And as we heard from our 20 Minutes with Tim, that's the way to do it, man. Just sit down and write. Get into it. How did you, obviously you're driven, you have a demon on your back that's whipping you, frothing you into all of these creative venues. Were words always a part of that, or was that something that came a little later on?
I didn't really start writing in earnest until I was in probably 8-9 years ago, which would have put me in my early 30s. I think I had been researching a novel. I hope you could see my air quotes on the podcast. for about 5 years. And I'd written about 200 words. So I think NaNoWriMo actually inspired me to chuck all the research and just start writing. And it was the first year of that I was aware of it. I don't know, 2002, 2003, something like that.
Okay. Very cool. Well, and you brought a story with you for the workshop, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Awesome. So let's go ahead and we'll turn the mic over to you, Rusty. Give us title and genre and format and all of that good stuff. Introduce us to some of the key characters, protagonist, antagonist, and then give us some basic quick signposts of the story idea insofar as you have it. And from that point, we will start workshopping. But for now, my friend, the mic is all yours. We will not get in the way.
All right, fantastic. The title, so far the working title, is The Ascension Artifact. It is an epic fantasy story. Hook line would be, an orphaned teenage boy must clear his name of murder and of consorting with the wicked gods that torment mankind while preventing a megalomaniac from ascending to godhood and destroying the world. The theme would be, how much evil is justifiable when it's in service for a noble cause? The background on the world, it's a story set in a medieval-esque world where magic rules, but humans for the most part find it incomprehensible. There's rumors and legends of humans that are practitioners of magic, but no one has seen one in living memory. The story set in an idyllic village where no one lacks for food, the weather's never bad, people tend not to get sick. However, traveling outside of this idyllic village is only done in the rarest and dire of circumstances, because the world beyond is a land of nightmare. The gods, sometime in the ancient past, were driven to suicide or insanity, and they poured all their rage towards mankind. And the normally absent elder gods, who are aloof and don't get involved in the world of men, stepped in and gave men wards, which protected them from these younger demigods. And none of their magic could overcome these wards, and that's what saved mankind from extinction. That's a backstory there. The characters, we got several. I'll try to run through them real quick. We got Jeb, who's a protagonist. He's a 15-year-old orphan who's accused of bringing down the wards early in the book, and he's had a crush on our female protagonist since he was a small boy. Our female protagonist, Edith, she's a little bit older, and she it's significant that she fled her husband, her marriage, when the wards came down, and she is missing and suspected of being murdered. She's very strong-willed, and she makes rash decisions. Raj is a middle-aged blacksmith who is married to Edith. He's our story's antagonist. He's kind of a bad guy who's got a lust for power. He's not altogether evil, but he sure seems that way. And there's a henchman named Bit, who is a foil for Jeb most of the time. And we've got Mo, who's a town constable, who gets murdered very early in the story, but he is a viewpoint character who hopefully kind of sets the stage, his murder does, for a lot of stuff that follows. And the story as it stands now, it begins with the wards fall down. The ancient wards that have protected the village have fallen, and alarms are sounded, and Jeb, our young main protagonist, stands with the rest of the men of the village together as they try to face down this mad god that's destroying homes, livestock, and killing people. And Jeb expects to die, as all men of the village do, because there's no real defense against this sort of stuff once the god got in. But there's a flash of light when the god attacks Jeb, and he's knocked unconscious. He awakes a few days later. The god's gone. The wards are back up, and nobody seems to understand what has happened, except for Edith, the young woman that Jeb has been had a crush on. She's missing, and looking for someone to blame, the town sort of turns to Jeb as maybe someone who is involved with the weirdness, because he finds out that he's been accused of consorting with the demons, because as soon as the demon moved to attack Jeb, it went up in a flash of light. The girl that everyone knows that he's secretly pined for is missing, and it looks like everything's laid at his feet. Now, the girl that he's accused of missing, I think I mentioned before, she actually fled from her abusive husband, and she runs out into the woods beyond, preferring death to facing her horrible husband, and she ends up getting taken in by a hermit who lives in the woods, who claims to be a wizard, and so she tells him about the wards falling down. He gets very upset and says that there's actually a city that's been hidden on the far side of the world that no one knows about. That has secret knowledge, and they have to go off on a big event to get over there. The village inside Jeb is kind of attacked by a mob of people. He blacks out. He comes to with lots of dead people at his feet. His brother is injured, so he has to go into hiding, and he is eventually driven out of town. And this guy Raj, who was the husband of the abusive girl, while Jeb is hiding, he overhears Raj and a few other people discussing their complicity and murdering the town constable Mo, which happened very recently in the book. And all of a sudden, he finds out why he's been accused, and he has to go on the run. Boy, that's a mess. Sorry, guys. But that's no a story as I've got. You know, well, there's 50 or so thousand pages of prose, 50,000, I'm sorry, words of prose. There is about 20 pages of backstory, and it's a lot to condense. So sure, I know it's sure a mess there. But the bottom line is that we got groups of people that are fleeing the village, this thwarted village, all chasing after one another. We have Edith who fled, Jeb who fled, and then we have Raj and his posse who have gone in chase of them because they found out that there's an artifact that he has been looking for his whole life. Legend says will give him godlike powers. And he believes that actually his ex-wife may have it, wearing it as a necklace. So he goes after her. And Jeb, being forced out of the village, is also trying to save her when he finds out she's alive. And that's kind of that.
Okay. Do you have an end game?
Yeah, I do have an end game. In the end, what I want to happen is I want this bad guy, Raj, he gets this artifact he's looking for, and he gets to ascend to godhood only to find out that this artifact that he found was only half of the artifact, and the other half was in Jeb's possession. That was the reason why that the godling, when it attacked him, it flashed and disappeared. And it's the mate, I guess, to the one that Edith had been wearing.
Okay.
And so anyway, he's able to use his half of the artifact to kind of take over, you know, to fight the guy to stand still and overcome him and, you know, good wins, that sort of thing.
Huzzah. All right, cool. Well, let me ask you before we get into this, Rusty, what are you hoping to get out of this discussion?
Well, the issue is, and I set up a very complicated soap opera in the first act between all the major characters. And what I don't really have is a second act. And the soap opera is not really the larger story. It's just the soap opera, you know.
Sure.
So they're not really connected. That's an issue. My magic system that I kind of came up with, it's not very well thought out. And I think it would certainly show. Those are two big deals.
Okay. And I can guarantee you that Brian, Tim, and myself all have things that have twigged for us.
Definitely.
So we'll kind of romp into this. But before we do, Brian, please cover our asses and give us the Roundtable Podcast disclaimer, if you would be so kind.
Absolutely. In the course of this workshop, you will hear a lot of advice and ideas and thoughts and all kinds of different things that we can come up with from Dave, myself, and Master Tim. And you, as the writer, are under no obligation to use any of them and more than welcome to throw out anything that we have to say as complete and total bullshit.
Bam. Cool, right. Rusty?
Good deal.
Awesome. All right. Well, it is our habit, our custom here at the Roundtable to always defer to our guest host for opening comments, questions of clarification, trying to wrap our heads around the ideas that are put out, and then launching into a discussion as to how we can dig out the literary gold inherent in all these ideas. So, Tim Pratt, if you would be so kind, sir, lead us off. What's your first impression of Rusty's story idea? Any questions of clarification you might have? We'll start with you. We'll go around the table, and then we'll dive in.
Sure. You've got a lot going on, which is good for this kind of epic fantasy. Absolutely. You want to have a lot of balls in the air, a lot of things that you can work with, and having a lot of characters who all have very specific goals that are in conflict with one another is wonderful. So that's great. I assume that you have a couple of parallel plot lines with Edith and Hermit Wizard running on one line and Jeb running on the other line. I presume you're planning on having them intersect at some point.
I do. Yeah.
Well, that's good. It's a little easier to keep track of. And plus, anytime readers see parallel plot lines like that, you have built-in suspense as they're expecting to see them come together and wanting to see them do it. Have a lot of fun. If you're just looking for complications to get you through the second act, you can have a lot of fun with near misses. You can have a lot of fun with stuff almost but not quite working out. You can have a lot of fun with misunderstandings when they do run into each other. So those are some possibilities for ways to complicate matters. The broader point I would make, you mentioned that you have your soap opera and you have your sort of big epic fantasy story and all your backstory and all your mythology. And what I would counsel is embrace the soap opera, embrace the human level drama, because, you know, there's nobody who loves the Silmarillion more than they love Lord of the Rings, you know?
Good point.
Expository thing about the backstory. What's interesting is how it impacts the lives of the characters. And what's interesting is seeing it revealed through what the characters do through their actions. So that's the only point I would really embrace the soap opera. Let it remain soap opera. Big villains. You know, I would make sure that you have a good sense of what the villain's goals are and why he has those goals. You know, that's such a lust for power that he's willing to leave the only safe place in the world to go into a place that sounds like it's certain death. You know, there needs to be some motivation for besides just being a megalomaniacal asshole. That's the only other thing I would say at this point. But I mean, it sounds like you have a fantastic setup with a lot of momentum and a lot of potential.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brian, first thoughts?
Yeah. I think that Tim kind of zeroed in on a lot of the things that I was looking at specifically, because I have a tendency to, you know, go very locally with things. One of the things that stood out to me was that Raj, so far, your antagonist, has the strongest journey aspect. Like, he knows what it is that he wants. He has motivation for going after certain things. And your protagonists, I haven't heard yet what their motivation is or what their forward story is. And it seems like so far it's a lot of stuff that's happening to them. And, you know, with Jeb, especially, I like the idea that, you know, this whole thing with the demon happens and he has no idea why. But then it's, you know, I have to get out of here, and that's about as much as I got of his story. And so as a protagonist, I want to know, what is it that he wants, and what is he going to be actively pursuing, as opposed to just being a participant in things where things are happening around him? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, he needs, again, I've written a soap opera where he's madly in love with this married girl, right?
Sure.
And, yeah. And so, I say madly in love. He's got a big crush on her. So, from my thing, the only thing that he really wants is her, which, by the way, I don't intend on him getting, in any sort of resolution. But that was his only motivation. Everything else does happen to him. You're right.
Sure. And you know, that could be it, you know, that you don't necessarily need more than that. If it's that he believes that she's alive and the rest of the town doesn't, then now he has a very specific journey, and he has to not only prove that she's alive, but he wants her to be alive. So he's going to go look for her. And then the only other thing that I had a question about was, you know, at the end, it turns out that Edith and Jeb both separately have a piece of this artifact. Why do they have them in the first place? And have you kind of fleshed that out? Where did they get them from? And do they know anything about the power that this artifact yields?
The answers are, yeah, I've got, it's just, you know, there's so much. Yeah, I've got a long history of the artifacts and how they became split and where they came from and how they came into their possessions, which hopefully makes sense. But now the part about them knowing about it, that would be no. And the idea is that this is, really, it's an epic fantasy, but really it's just framed that way. It's really a post-singularity, post-scarcity science fiction world that's 40,000 years, where the people that were still here, they don't know their history. And so what they think is magic is just leftover and forgotten technology.
Sure.
And so these artifacts are actually kind of some ancient weapons and, you know, that sort of thing. And anyway, the point is they can't leave their wards. They have to be self-sufficient. So they're always recycling items. And that they find in the ground. And anyway, living there in the same place for millennia, lots of junk tends to accumulate and history gets forgotten. And so these have been passed down as heirlooms. Anyway, but it's even more involved. I'll stop. I'll shut up about it. But it's more involved.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
Well, Rusty, I'll echo sentiment. Wonderful framework that you've set up here. And I have a few questions of clarification. First of all, what is the world like outside of the village?
Well, the thought was these mad gods have more or less have free reign, and these are entities that and you're not supposed to know at all in this story, except to know that something happened in the past that has driven them to this and to blame the living humans.
Okay, right.
What was your question?
What was the outside world? You talk about the mad gods pouring their fury and rage and madness into this world, and I wonder what does that look like? How does that change the world when a god infuses a planet with their lunacy? What do you see that looking like?
Well, the only thing that really I have is a lot of monsters and chimeras that kind of run through the land. You know, monsters that were designed specifically to cause fear in humans, that sort of thing. And but as far as like an environment, it's not a smoldering wasteland necessarily.
Are there other villages that are protected like this?
In my story, it was supposed to be, these are really and again, I know you don't want to hear all this, but it's essentially, we're looking at we're Amish people, people who rejected technology thousands of years in the past, or other Luddites or Mennonites, you know, whoever, and these small enclaves, everyone else is gone. They've done this, uploaded their consciousness to AIs and are exploring the cosmos, you know, that sort of thing. And these people were left behind. They're just people who want to make wagon wheels and farm. And so they don't have any real understanding of what's happening in the world around them.
Okay, let me ask you this then. Are the gods really gods?
No, they're uplifted humans who are facing a bigger threat from outside, you know, their point of view. And they've been essentially defeated, and they're shadows of their former selves, still godlike to men, but they are not what they once were. And
okay.
And again, there's a backstory there that can go on forever.
Sure. I'm one of the, when I come at these things, I like to understand the full context and you know, some semblance of the backstory, but also the vibe. So really, we're not. This isn't exactly medieval. This is post-apocalyptic.
Well, you know, hopefully it's so far post that it's going to feel... I want it to feel a lot like a fantasy story. And I want a reader reading it to think they're reading a fantasy novel, not because I want to pull the wool over their eyes, but hopefully they would feel the same.
But when you do the ultimate reveal... that it wasn't magic at all. It was mental powers and uplifted technology and psionics and AI. Is that going to happen at some point in this story?
I have broad strokes for like a trilogy.
Okay.
And I don't think it would have to be revealed.
Okay. Okay.
For it to work, Excellent. Maybe it would. I don't know, but I don't think it will.
Okay.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And sorry. I will also jump in and echo Brian's sentiment that Jeb and Edith can probably do with a little more laser focus in terms of their objectives and their goals. And I've got some ideas about that, but I'd like to turn it back over to Tim at this point. And Tim, what's the next step? What can we start exploring to fine-tune some of these elements and make this into a tight story?
Sure. I like post-apocalyptic things that look like fantasy. There are ways to do it where you play fair. Kim Scholes has a series, Psalms of Isaac, I think it's called. That's the same sort of idea. And he just gives you some hints. You know, like there's... strange mechanical men who we as modern readers recognize as robots who are still lingering from a long time ago. You know, in Stephen King's Dark Tower series, he would have the people wandering through the desert wastelands and find the remnants of an old gas station that still has old pumps. You know, some hint that there was a different world before. And obviously, if you're this far in the future, then a lot of the man-made artifacts are going to be gone. But you can still give some suggestions so that if you do decide in book three to reveal, in fact, the wider scale, that it doesn't come completely out of nowhere. And plus, those details are cool. When you put in weird little anachronistic things, readers like them. They think it's neat. So I think that's not necessarily a bad idea. So things I would talk about in terms of making something that has a lot of forward momentum, you definitely do want your main characters to have some motivations. You want them to be running to something, not just away from something. It sounds like Edith with the hermit wizard might have something she's really running toward, which is great. For your main protagonist, it might be better if he's not necessarily ridden out of town on a rail, if he leaves because he wants to find Edith. You know, if he goes of his own free will, you know, if maybe he's running ahead of the mob, but if, you know, his principal motivation isn't just escape, it can be a bit more compelling. The other thing is, I want to make sure that the wizard character is not just your magical old guy who's been, he needs to also have his own arc, his own thing. And there are a lot of stuff you can do. I mean, if you have singularity situation, you can have people who are punished and sent into exile by being forced to live in human bodies, for example, being kicked out of the uplifted collective. You know, that would allow you to have, and that's just an idea, obviously, just allow you to have somebody who has some knowledge of the greater scheme of things, who can see the big picture and yet operate on a level that is comprehensible to your main characters. In general, the main things I think about when I'm constructing a story is how to keep the narrative driving forward, and the way you do that is by creating suspense. And, you know, there are essentially two kinds of suspense. There's what the French literary critic Roland Barthes called hermeneutic and proeretic codes. And I know it sounds a little English classy, but hermeneutic is basically suspense that comes from not knowing stuff. And you've got a ton of that stuff set up in your book. You know, mysteries that need to be revealed. You know, things that don't make any sense to the main characters that they're trying to figure out. You know, what is this artifact? What does it do? What's the real nature of the world? You have all these great kinds of questions set up that are hermeneutic suspense. So that's marvelous. And the other kind of hermeneutic suspense, which is suspense that derives from action. It's what, you know, are the bad guys going to catch them? You know, are they going to survive the natural disaster that they just encountered? Is the building going to collapse on them? All that stuff. And those are the two kinds of suspense that keep readers turning pages. And you have a lot of potential for both of those, and you want to weave both of those in. And generally, the best way to structure it is to have big questions that don't get answered for a while, kind of string the reader along, and then keep them getting little kicks of satisfaction through the proeretic suspense, through the physical stuff. You know, lots of close encounters and close shaves and dangers and, you know, narrow hair's breadth escapes, all that stuff will keep them turning the pages, you know, in the moment, while the bigger questions keep them thinking about the book all the time, even when they're not sitting there reading it. And you have great potential to set up both those things. And, you know, I would say don't play super coy. Let them know that there's something weird about this world, that it's not your standard sort of fantasy universe. Give us something. Give us the mouth of a subway tunnel. Give us some sort of anachronistic thing to let them know, wow, there's more going on here than I thought. And that'll set up more questions. So just be sure that you have big mysteries, little mysteries, and stuff happening just on a ground moment-to-moment level. And honestly, all a story is characters who are trying to do something and they either achieve it or they don't. And, you know, you've got a great potential here. So I think it could be really good.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's excellent advice. Excellent Definitely. Advice.
Yeah.
Brian?
I'm intrigued with your antagonist, and big surprise, right?
Yeah, really. What a shock. Brian's down with the antagonist. Yeah.
I love the antagonist.
Good, because I think he could use some help. So, Brian, dive in, man.
Okay, so here's what I'm looking at. It almost seems to me, just if I look at kind of the overall arc of your or the journey of your story and where they end up at the end, that Raj has to have a little bit more knowledge of his world than the people around him. And that could also be part of what plays into, you know, his abusive nature is sort of the stresses of having this knowledge and knowing that there's something out there that he can go after and not being able to, and sort of being, you know, tied down, not necessarily by his wife, but by, you know, the society in general and the things that are going on in his village. But I think that if he knows something that a lot of the others don't, like about this particular artifact, he has knowledge of it that other people have never heard of it before or never seen it. Going into where he gets that knowledge from could be a really interesting sort of side piece that kicks some stuff in motion. What do you think about that? What are your thoughts?
I agree with you 100%. Now, I did as written, and again, you know, 50,000 words, give or take, there's a flashback scene where, you know, sometimes I told you the village has to be self-sufficient, but some things sure. They just can't get. So it's a big, like, you know, semi-annual or every 2-year event where they have to make the pilgrimage out of the village to try to get simple things like iron ore, you know, so they can make new nails, you know, that right. sort of thing. And so it's a big deal. And anyway, so when he's outside the wooded areas, he actually has a confrontation with the goblin who gives them a spiel about the world is ending. They have to have something that's hidden inside the wooded village, you know, when he's young. And so he builds his life trying to get that goal. But even this god isn't entirely sure, because it's been so long, what it would look like, where it would be, that sort of thing.
So what if the god, I mean, you had mentioned the ascended beings that the high-tech people had literally gone up and gone and become gods. What if this godling that touched Raj early in his life, what if he imparted into Raj a slice of that godhood? What if Raj has access on some level and he doesn't understand it, but maybe, you know, maybe he was affected with nanites that allow him to access the staggering Wi-Fi that still is in existence around the world. And he can, through his dreams or through his research or whatever, can access and tap into just fragments, maddening bits of information that lead him to see a bigger picture, not the right one, because as Tim pointed out, you want the smaller mysteries leading to bigger ones, blah, 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 blah. So he's making assumptions that he's like the chosen one, blah, 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 and work that way. Does that fit into your model of things?
Oh, yeah, that's way better than what I have.
Well, and the notion of him as a blacksmith, that seems humble to me. For someone who is, well, and I don't know, I'm
you could play with that, and you could, maybe he didn't choose that profession. Maybe this is a village, you know, because we're talking about post-apocalyptic, and so you may have, well, in a sense, you're talking about post-apocalyptic, so you may have some sense of dystopia where maybe these people don't have that kind of choice, and that plays into his abusive nature as well, that here he's stuck in this position that is way below his means or his intellectual capacity because of this encounter with this god, but he doesn't have a choice. He's forced into it. It's an apprenticeship by assignment.
Yeah, Tim, what do you think?
Okay. Say maybe he's a blacksmith because that's the closest you can get to being a technocratic engineer. You know,
Yeah,
he's interested in systems and how things work, and thinks he could do a better job, but is a bit abusive, sadistic, and megalomaniacal. Those are character traits that never go together.
Well, and the idea totally for him being a blacksmith totally stemmed from they have to continually recycle metals and materials that have been melted down to be reused, and I thought that would be a way for him to try to find the artifact.
Well, and plus things, right? If they have if they go out and scrounge for scrap or whatever, which you have to do if you're blacksmithing at that level, then that's an opportunity for him to encounter things that are going to give him hints of this wider world. So I don't think it's a choice. I think, yeah, he does think he should be a king, but I think blacksmith might be actually a good path to some of the stuff that you want him to discover.
Sure. And maybe I was lured into an inaccurate assumption. I love the idea, Tim, of the technocrat of the community, maybe amping it up just a little bit. Now, Rusty, I'm wondering, the wards around this settlement,
right?
I'm fixated on why this one settlement in the whole world, why did it get wards?
Right.
And are those wards really like laser cannons that are blasting things as they come in? Or is it a psionic, a force field? And is it possible that Raj is one who maybe is like a blacksmith's technocrat / quote-unquote priest who has knowledge and understanding and can maintain those wards? Tell me more about why this one settlement, and what are those wards?
Well, the elder gods in my story are that first generation of sentient AI, kind of, if you think, you know, Skynet or whatever, but more benign. Anyway, and whereas the younger gods are just humans who are uplifted. So the AI is truly gone and off exploring the wider universe. They don't have a part really in humanity at all.
Okay.
And it's not entirely well thought out about why this particular village, except for men in general, if you are a human functioning in a normal society, you've gone through this uplift process, which is why the remnants of true humanity are either Luddites or you know, religious folks who would eschew technology for some reason or another, who simply got left behind when humanity ascended and became post-human. No,
but there's got to be a reason why. What if that this village is set? I mean, thinking back to when the cataclysm happened, humans, you know, running, screaming, "Oh my God, the world destroying!" Where do you go? You go to the place that's the safest. So, what if this last bastion of untainted humanity is like, I don't know, the primary research facility, a military outpost, something that is I don't know, vitally important to the rebooting that may be coming on down the road, that will reinitiate the global web, that will allow humanity to subvert the mad gods. There's something about this place that it used to be something, and that is another one of those mysteries. Because what I was thinking was, Raj is the antagonist, and maybe that's just because he makes hard choices, and he's pissed off about, he feels the burden of protecting his people, these people, and his skill, his knowledge, his whatever, his technocracy allows him to do that, but it's just not enough. And if he has a network of friends, and I don't want to add another POV, but it is an epic story, but as these guys, as Jeb and Edith and Raj are blazing into this mad wilderness of insane gods, see also crazed scientist AI, blah blah, what if there's another group that has unhinged or found some thing that allows them to delve deeper into the mystery, so that you can have this parallel revelation going on of somebody back at the village finds something, and then Edith and the wizard find something, and then Jeb and bam, 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 and by the end you've got this layered experience of, oh my god, this is what's really going on, that type of thing. Does that fly for you?
Sure, that's what I want.
Fabulous.
What if the people believe that the wards are there to protect them, but it's the opposite? What if the wards are there to keep them in, as opposed to protect them from other things, to keep other things out? You know what I mean? Like, they think that they're being protected, but really the outside world, it's, well, we have ascended, and this is not just a reminder of what we used to be, but almost vermin at this point, and disease that can bring us back down, and we don't want them getting out of this.
Or prison. Yes, exactly. The mad gods that are out there, the ascended humans that are driven mad, the only connection they have to their humanity is through the people in this place. Without the humans in this village, their consciousness would shatter, because they have no touchstone back to the essence of what it means to be just a simple human.
Right. Yeah, you have too high an opinion of humanity. It could be a game preserve, the same way we, have habitats for monkeys.
Yeah. Sure.
Aren't they cute? They're a sort of curiosity. Let's protect them. Put a fence around them, and we'll look in on them from time to time. I think that'd be a more likely way that our uplifted descendants would look at us.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's not necessarily a going out into the wilderness story. It's an escaping from captivity story, only they don't realize it.
Right.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, how would the escaping from captivity story differ significantly from the other one?
Might try to put them back. There might be somebody uplifted who actually gives a crap about this place. So it could be another strand of tension and pursuit, as if you need another one of those. But
well, actually, that raises a really good point, Tim. Rusty, what if these mad gods aren't as mad? They aren't deranged and insane and just frothing and raging and howling, but they actually have an agenda. That they're trying to accomplish something. They can still be insane, but that doesn't mean they're gibbering and reasonless.
No, and they're not. And hopefully you would see that from reading, and I know I did a bad job in my synopsis anyway, but you're okay. Right. They've got an agenda. They want the artifact for a specific reason, which would be purpose of book 2 or 3. But yes, absolutely. You're dead on.
Okay.
Yeah. And even if this is almost a game preserve kind of a thing, you'll have, in any society, even these ascended mad insane gods, there's going to be prejudices, and so you'll probably have some that are like, we need to just wipe these things away and be done with them, and others that, no, we need to preserve them. And so, because I'm trying to figure out if that's the case, then where does this mini god come from that comes in and starts terrorizing the village? And so you may have some that are heavily prejudiced against these remaining humans, and let's just annihilate them and get rid of them, and that's one that slips through.
And by the way, it's not like the words are already literary gold, so we can change them
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk a little bit about Edith. In talking about Raj and our exploration of him and understanding him a little bit better, I'd like to empower her a little more. You know, running away from an abusive husband, I get that. That makes perfect sense. But what if his abuse is not beating her? What if she is just as savvy in the ways of blacksmithery, see also technocracy, whatever, as Raj is? What if, you know, if we go with the idea that Raj has somehow been seeded with some taint of these mad gods and has access to this realm, what if she's not just his wife but also his partner and has observed this change in him? Maybe this change didn't happen when he was a kid. Maybe it's happened just recently.
Yeah.
And as his mind tries to wrestle with this influx of knowledge, she finds him becoming more and more angry and enraged.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got the fact that she still loves him, but something is wrong with him, and that way her mission can be, you know, my God, you know, when the wards come down, I as soon as you said that, I thought that was Raj's fault.
Yes.
Raj was doing something. Maybe he had a seizure, an attack of this madness, and that caused everything to short out, and she was there to see it. And he blathered something. He mumbled something in his delirium, and she realizes, holy crap, this guy's insane, and we're all hosed. And look, the wards on the game preserve have dropped. Let's get the hell out of here. And so she runs off, and now her purpose is to get her husband back. And that gives her a nicely conflicted intent and also empowers her with more knowledge. Does that jibe with where you're – would that fit, Rusty?
Well, as it's written, that's way out of left field. But
that's me.
It's really good. Well, before, you know, I had her – she married him because she's – the prize of the village, and it's a status thing for him. And she had been in love with someone else who, and it was a whole subplot, but he actually was gay and hiding, you know, and she found out and it broke her heart. And she turned to this guy who ended up being much worse than she thought. It made sense when I wrote it.
Okay.
But yours sounds really awesome.
And he could still, you know, he could still be gay, and there's still allow for the love and the bonding between humans that has nothing to do with sexuality. There's nothing wrong with that as a character dynamic. I think that works. Tim, what do you think, man? Are we going too far afield, or how's this sitting with you?
I think figuring out what her motives are and giving her more agency is never a bad idea. And I'm actually interested in her plot with old wizard guy because he interests me, you know, and he clearly knows more than anybody else. And so she's going to know more than anybody else. So I definitely think it's a good idea to think about her. And if it is sort of an equal time plot line, you know, running in parallel until they converge, then it's all definitely stuff that you have to think about. And leaving the wilderness because you would rather die than deal with your abusive husband is understandable. I think it's a little better if she thinks, fuck this, I bet I can make my way.
I
learned enough from him to know how to, you know, get out, get past the wards. I know what to expect, you know, give her, you know, that degree of agency rather than having her just be running away, have her thinking, screw this, I'm going to make another life, you know, the only people in the world. Also make sure your breeding pool is big enough. Kind of the technical magical hand wave for how they can not, you know, degenerate completely with a limited breeding pool. Anyway,
the Smurfs do it pretty well.
Yeah, but they're Smurfs.
And I do have a science fiction background, so I've spent a lot of time actually working out the biology. I think I have a viable gene pool to go from, but you're right. Those are the things I get lost in. My Cimmerillion, I guess.
Brian, what else you got, man?
Well, I'm interested to see, because we've got Tim here, and one of the things that Rusty was asking about was his magic, you know, the way that magic works in his world. So I was interested to see what, you know, what Tim's ideas are for that. And I don't know if maybe he'll need a little more from Rusty or not, but what do you think?
Oh, well, no. I mean, knowing that it's post-singularity secret tech, that's awesome. I mean, you can do all kinds of cool stuff with them. I get a little resistant sometimes to the notion of magic systems where magic is an alternate physics. But in this case, it's not. It's actually, right? It's just highly advanced. So that gives you tons of possibility. I would just find the most cutting edge stuff you can think about and go even farther. Let's have spooky action at a distance. You know, let's have, you know, selective removal of the Higgs boson and thus removing the property of mass from an object. I mean, wackiest stuff you can. Let's have some tachyons giving us glimpses into what happened in the past. You know, there's all kinds of stuff you can do just with, and if you come from the science fiction background, I'm sure you know, that's the great thing about science fiction. You can take the barest hint of what we're seeing, you know, in New Scientist and Scientific American and stuff and just push far as you possibly can. Have a life, you know, have artificial life forms. Figure out, it's, I mean, sort of the point of the singularity is you don't know what it's going to be like, but try and imagine what these uplifted creatures would be doing on Earth. You know, they have this biosystem. What would they do with it? Let's think about the things scientists do now. I mean, that's how you're setting weirder, right? It's this place, this lump of rock and stuff. Uplifted creatures are going to have kind of limited interest in it, but there's, you know, the, how many Civil War reenactors are there on this planet? Uplifted too, who want to mess around with stuff on Earth, who want to play God or who want to do little experiments. I mean, you could have, you know, Orson Scott Card wrote a book called Characters and Viewpoint. He talks about different kinds of stories, and one of them is the milieu story. Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, you know, where you go and you look at the weird stuff. And obviously that's not all you have in your story, but you can have some milieu stuff. You can just have awesome eyeball kicks and weirdness as they're going on this journey across the world and just draw it. You know, it'll actually be a very satisfying and self-consistent magic system because it's not physics, it's real physics. So I think it could be really cool. I really like stories like that, actually. The sort of so far in the future, we can't tell that it's not magic. That's good stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Cool. Did you say highball kicks?
Highball kicks, the Sterling cyberpunk idea that on every page you kick your reader in the eyeball with some fresh spectacle.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Eyeball kicks. Yes, definitely. We need to have some of those. We definitely need to have some of those. Well, God. Gentlemen, I'm looking at the time, and I'm seeing that we're winding towards the end of our discussion. So I'd like to go around the table one more time. First of all, starting with you, Rusty, I know that our time is tight, and we didn't necessarily get to everything that was on your shopping list. I hope we gave you something. Is there something else, another topic that you'd like to focus on in these final minutes that we can discuss?
No, I, you know, you guys did a lot with a really bad synopsis and you didn't give me a hard time about it. And I love you guys forever for it. If you want to throw in stuff, you know, I'm raking it all in because this is a great opportunity for me. So please just
awesome.
Keep talking. Well,
Tim, final thoughts, final suggestions. So maybe some what ifs or, you know, pie in the sky. You could do this, do that. Some final wrap up to send Rusty on his way.
I will. It's going to be more of a general thing that I think is a good idea in novels in general, which is that about halfway through the book, you want to have a turn. You want to have some revelation that recontextualizes everything. Someone that you thought was a hero turns out to not be a villain. Something that you thought you understood turns out to be completely wrong. I mean, the turn in this could even be that it seems to be fantasy, and then you get to a turn halfway through and you discover, nope. Post-singularity, science fiction, you know, or just some sort of thing. Or you think that, you know, depending on how you do the viewpoints, you think that Edith is just fleeing from her abusive husband. And then the turn is, oh, nope, she was a mastermind all along. She had a plan. She had a, you know, just something like that. That's just another way that you keep the reader on their toes. You let them know that they can't trust necessarily anything. And I love any time I encounter that in books, and I try and put something like that in most of my books, you know, just get halfway through and then just absolutely jerk the narrative around 180 degrees, you know, turn it away from where they think it is. And there's a lot of things you could do in this book to keep the readers.
Oh, God, yes. Many, many, many ways, many times. Brian, what you got, son?
I, of course, you know, my obsession is always the antagonist. And I think that, you definitely know what you want to do with him. And I think he's got a good start at being a really good antagonist. And one of the things that comes up over and over and over again that I just want to kind of reiterate is that, anything that he does there, it's never, and I think Tim touched on this, it's never, because he, is just pure evil, there's always a reason behind it that he thinks is going to benefit someone. And I think that there are some really cool things with what you've set up with him that you can really do with this character. And then I also want to say that with Jeb, do the same thing. You know, that everything that he does is not necessarily a selfish act, and that he has something else going on that he's striving to achieve. And I really like what you're doing with this, and I think that it's going to be pretty awesome when you throw it all together.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And for myself, I'll definitely echo all those sentiments. But also, just the scope of what you're building is so rich. The layers that you've defined, the area outside the enclosure, the village, the game preserve, whatever it ends up being, the military base, that existence and the beings that inhabit it and their agenda. I know we didn't get a chance to talk about that. I will look forward to reading about that when you actually print this thing. But understanding them and giving them that same humanity that Tim was talking about, even though they're mad, even though they're uplifted, giving them a POV, you know, was something that occurred to me is, you know, it doesn't have to be a frequent POV, but it could be, you know, maybe an italicized page at the beginning of each chapter as you look into the eyes of a different mad god, and just give a view of the world through their eyes, a glimpse that sets a different context and makes the reader wonder what the heck is really going on here. That was something that occurred to me. Understanding those levels, giving them real agendas and motivations, human agendas and motivations. And then the world itself, because there's artifacts, there's relics, there's mechanisms, there's tech here. And yes, it's post-apoc, but it's still there. And some of the subterranean stuff, that's always been, you know, the original Total Recall, when they discover, oh my god, the aliens put a terraformer in the middle of Mars. Oh my god. And those moments for me are just, oh wow, that's awesome. And I can see, I don't know if that's where you're going with this, but those are things that I always enjoy. Understanding that there is a larger context that the smaller dramas are playing out in, and making sure that Jeb and Edith and Raj have their very specific place. And I go back to, I'm rambling. I go back to the theme, how much evil is allowed in the name of the greater good? I meant to go deeper into that, and I'm not going to now, but revisit that theme. Look at your scenes, look at chapters, and see if that theme evolves. Fabulous, but did you touch that theme? Did you reinforce that in some way? Is this the story that you want to tell? And if it's going off the tracks, figure out why and say, ooh, I like this, let's go off the tracks, or not. But just be mindful of that constant thread that sustains every good story. The stronger that thread is, the more the reader is engaged, and the more the characters are aligned to the story being told. Okay, awesome.
Wow.
God, no kidding. I'm looking at, holy crap, dude, shut up. So, Rusty, here's the deal. When you write this and you put it up on Kindle, or it gets picked up by a traditional pub, however you choose to put it out in the world, as soon as that happens, you let us know, and we will have you back on the show, and we will knight you, sir. We will make you a knight of the round table. That's the carrot, man.
And it's a beautiful golden carrot.
That's right. It's a beautiful golden carrot. We'll put your picture up on there. We'll set up our knight's hall, and we will get you up there. So please, by all means, get out there and make this story happen, because it's a very cool framework. Rusty, thank you, man. I know it's never easy to put your baby up there for discussion, and we really appreciate you coming out and engaging in a very cool conversation. This was a good talk.
Yeah.
I loved it.
So, and Tim, dude, I cannot thank you enough for, your insights, for your perspectives, and for attuning them for a short time on Rusty's story. It's been enlightening for me, and I know our listeners will have gotten a big kick out of it too. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Sir.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's fun. Thanks so much, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bri, thoughts, considerations?
I'm ready to smoke a cigarette, and I don't even smoke.
I hear you, man. Have a cigarette.
Yeah. No, this was a good one, and it was like I said before, a super treat for me, and so I'm glad that it came together.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And friends, thank you as always for tuning in. We appreciate that greatly. We feel free to continue this discussion. I know that I'm thinking of some very specific individuals out there who have been commenting, and others that may be thinking about it. We can continue this discussion. In fact, several of us have on the comment threads for these posts. So if you have an idea for Rusty, by all means, come back to the website. Leave a comment down there. Let us know what your thoughts and impressions are, and we can continue this process even past the podcast, which is fabulous. And anything can help Rusty get a stronger beat on what he's doing and make the story that much better. So do visit the website for that. Leave us a spread the word. That, I guess, you know, reviews on iTunes are always awesome. That's like, you know, strawberry compote on our Belgian waffles. That's just fabulous. But spreading
it really is. Yeah.
It is. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But spreading the word is always helpful too. Let people know if you're digging the show. I'm betting you know somebody else that would probably get a kick out of it. So help spread the word that way. That would be fabulous. And guys, you know, we're all sitting here wrung out and exhausted after a great discussion, but in a couple of days, it's going to start all over again. New guest hosts, new guest writers, new fabulous workshops, so please do stay tuned. Between now and then, Bri.
Yeah.
Any advice, any sage wisdom to impart unto our listeners?
Yeah, go write and then take a nap.
And then take a nap. Have a cigarette. Relax. Absolutely. Yes. Go right. Go right. Go find what you're looking for, because you always do. So set your sights on the wow. Go for the top shelf goodness, because friends, when you set your sights for something, you do find it. The world, that's just the way the world works, baby. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will see you again in a couple of days. Until then, stay cool, stay amazing, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
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 This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.